From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Once again, LA County is under stay-at-home orders. And once again, restaurants were the first to feel the blow. If you think this feels like Groundhog Day, you're not alone. If you can stretch your memory back to the before times, you'll remember that we used to air a restaurant review every week on the show. The review that was slated to run on March 21st, the first week of the first shutdown, was about a newish restaurant in East Hollywood called Found Oyster. To this day, that interview sits unedited in our archives, a relic from a distant past when dining rooms were places to gather. Found Oyster is a shrine to Old Bay, a place where you can get milky chowder, fried oysters, and peel-and-eat prawns. The Seafood Shack, located on a quiet block down the street from the Big Blue Scientology Center in East Hollywood, recently celebrated its first anniversary. In his written review, LA Times critic Bill Addison described the restaurant's feel as at once like a refuge and a party. My, how times have changed. But the team is still shucking. In addition to takeout, they've launched a weekend seafood shop where you can order fresh seafood to cook at home. Joining us for this week's edition of In the Weeds is co-owner and chef Ari Collender.
My name is Ari Collender. I'm the chef and partner of Found Oyster in East Hollywood, Los Angeles. Found Oyster was built to be a place for everybody to come and enjoy an easy cup of chowder, an amazing piece of broiled fish, have a, you know, a Coors banquet beer or a really elegant glass of champagne. We go through pretty big lengths to get seafood from all over the country. We work with our partner Joe's family farm for oysters out of Cape Cod. We even trying to get into the Southeast seafood market as well to bring some amazing stuff from my hometown in Charleston, South Carolina, as well as locally caught and harvested shellfish. So Found Oyster is a shotgun style restaurant. It's very narrow. The kitchen comprises half of the space. It's about 750 square feet. So we can jam pack about 25 people or so inside if they're friendly. On any given night before the pandemic, Found Oyster was a buzz. You know, loud disco music playing and a lot of cheery nature all throughout. COVID brought our business to a halt, just like everyone else. You know, in the beginning, we paused to see what was going on. We did not have a good takeout option right away, so we decided to completely press the brakes. In the first months of the original quarantine, we took the time to think of a strategy that would give us the most longevity for any loans or relief that we could get. It took us about 2 months to put that together and reopen for takeout. Unfortunately, we, like I had mentioned before, are such a tiny restaurant. We don't have any patio space or parking lot behind the restaurant. It's just a narrow sidewalk on Fountain Avenue. So outdoor dining originally was just not even in the cards. Back in July, we finally petitioned the city to create a parklet out of two parking spaces in front of Found Oyster, which originally we had been approved for and then found out they ran out of funding. So that then got put on the back burner and we just decided to keep on trucking along with takeout only. We were very fortunate that that program got picked back up and our district councilman actually helped to expedite us through there very quickly. So about a month and a half ago, we were finally given the thumbs up to start planning and building. And we did just that. We built a deck on Fountain Avenue and built a trellis system, put some plants out, string lights, the whole, you know, proper COVID patio. All expenses accounted for. The patio cost us around $11,000. And we were able to get that set up about a week and a half before the county decided to shut outside dining again. I woke up the other morning to a couple texts from a friend and our GM mentioning that we had been recognized by Esquire as one of the best restaurants in the country. It definitely came out of left field. We can't really be the found oyster that we set out to be. And we're still, you know, able to give people a great experience, something that they want to come back for. I mean, part of us pivoting into, you know, the world of takeout was kind of shifting away from all the raw bar and crudos and broiled shellfish that we were doing in Found Oyster. We dubbed our takeout Overboard just to kind of create a different feeling than we had been able to before. The original idea behind the seafood market was truly to be able to provide the neighborhood with all kinds of seafood. Yeah, it definitely made sense with the amount that we go through and the diversity in which we use, but we actually started taking requests from people and have expanded the list of products and fish to be things we don't even use in the restaurant. We have everything from live lobster, Maine diver scallops, fresh oysters, clams, a variety of shellfish, as well as whole bronzino, black bass, yellowfin tuna, swordfish fillets. If there's one thing that I've learned in this pandemic, it's that you have to be ready to pivot at every second. You cannot wait and pray that one thing is going to work better than another, or that something or someone is going to bail you out. My staff and myself all find strength in the fact that this is what we do. This is who we are, and this is where we'll be moving forward. I mean, the pandemic is obviously nowhere near over, but at the same time, there's nothing else any of us would rather do.
That's chef and co-owner of Found Oyster, Ari Colander. Check out his East Coast Seafood Shack in East Hollywood by visiting foundoyster.com. And my personal tip, do not sleep on the fried chicken. After a quick break, we jump into one of my favorite topics of the year. It's our annual cookbook show. If you have a cookbook buying habit, you have been warned. You're about to be enticed. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. 2020 will be remembered for many things, one of which will be the year we found out where our kitchens were. We've been collectively cooking up a storm over the last 9 months, consulting with old cookbooks and new favorites. Celia Sack of Omnivore Books makes her yearly return to Good Food with a selection of her top picks for the food lovers in your life or simply to treat yourself. Hi, Celia.
Hello, Evan.
So one of the things, of course, we've all been seeking this year is comfort. What has been the biggest category for you?
You know, that's a really good question. I think, yes, comfort has been really, really important. But also, there have been different times that certain books, you know, because of so many different things that have happened this year, popularity has come and in some cases gone. One thing that happened when the pandemic first started and everyone was staying home was all of the bread books went crazy. In fact, publishers, you know, ran out of them because they'd been in print for years and suddenly everybody wanted them and I couldn't keep them in stock. And then after about 2 months, everyone said, forget this. I don't want to bake bread anymore. And so it totally came to a screeching halt and nobody nobody wanted to do that. And then when the Black Lives Matter protests started up again, a lot of people started thinking about supporting African-American authors. And so when that occurred, suddenly there was a renewed interest in cookbooks by African-American authors. All of Bryant Terry's really great vegan, Afro-vegan cookbook and Vegetable Kingdom, those all went out of print. The Edna Lewis books, Tony Tipton Martin's Jubilee, all of those were impossible to find for a while.
Has there been one book that's been more difficult than any other to keep in stock and is a must-have?
Well, yeah, actually, we've sold, I can't believe it, but because the book came out, I think, in October, and we've sold about 350 copies of this book called Dessert Person by Claire Saffitz. And then, of course, Ottolenghi, who also has a book called Flavor. His books are perennially popular, so that's also been the really big one.
Okay, so now comes my favorite part of our conversation each year, the speed round.
All right,
so
I'm ready.
Give me a title to gift to the following: The Baker.
Okay, for The Baker, I would go with, if you're really an excellent baker and you're interested in the science behind it, I would go with either A Good Bake by Melissa Weller, or a more advanced one also is Baking at the 20th Century Cafe, which is a fantastic place here in San Francisco that Michelle Polzine owns, and it's all Eastern European desserts, and her Russian honey cake is just famous and fabulous, and I think it takes 4 days to make. If you are just a lover of baking in general and don't want something so advanced, that Dessert Person I mentioned is great. Also, Pastry Love by Joanne Chang, who's got cafes in Boston. And the Magnolia Bakery Handbook came out, and I am dying to make the banana Nilla wafer pudding, which is one of my favorite desserts to have whenever I'm in New York.
Okay, for the child.
Okay, so when the protests started up, I thought a lot about what can I do to take part in some sort of way. And I thought, well, you know, there's so many kids' cookbooks out there. I want to have the most diverse selection possible. So I found them, you know, I found one called Bibimbap that's Korean. I found one that's called Vamos, Let's Go Eat, that's Mexican. I found 10 Gulab Jamuns is a counting book for with Indian flavor. Thank You Omu is an African book for kids that's all about soup. But my absolute favorite is one called What's Cooking at 10 Garden Street. And it's actually British, and it imagines an apartment building where every person in who lives there is an immigrant from a different country. And it shows their apartment and what they make from their country. And these kids sort of go around to each apartment and learn how to cook there. And that book, oh, is so cute. And the recipes really work.
What about for the barbecue and or the meat enthusiast?
Gosh, you always ask me when this is like an oral exam. I actually took notes this year, but I didn't get the
meat. It's okay. You won't
down.
Be graded.
Well, okay. I'm going to say one that actually, because it is meat-centric. There's this fabulous book called Red Sands that just came out by Caroline Eden. And it's about an area that, you know, there's so few areas in the world now that people don't really know about. But Central Asia is definitely one of those places. And this is all the stands, you know, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan. And it's her journey through there. She's a wonderful travel writer, but also it's heavy on the lamb. There's a lot of lamb dishes in it and lamb fat grilled over open fires in the desert and made into kebabs and wrapped in bread. And
that might be my favorite book of the whole year. What about the skilled home cook looking for a challenge?
Okay, so there's some great international ones this year, in addition to Red Sands. There's In Bibi's Kitchen by Hawa Hassan and Julia Tertian, who's a great recipe writer, and that's all about East African cooking. Wonderful, wonderful book, and unusual. Oh, another vegan, vegetarian, and also Advanced Home Cooking is East by Mirasota. That covers vegan and vegetarian cooking in India and all across Asia. And then I would say these two, Falestine and Parwana. Falestine is by Sammy Tamimi, who is Yota Motulenghi's business partner and sort of the cooking end of things. He runs the restaurants, and it's Palestinian. And Parwana, finally, a great Afghanistani book that, you know, for some reason, most Afghan cookbooks are always sort of small and paperback and usually out of print. And this one is finally here, and it's a lovely book, and I highly recommend it. So those are really fun for exploring new areas.
Okay, and now we come to, how shall I put this? The devoted eater who has been forced to crack an egg this year.
Well, which is actually quite a few people. You know, there are always really good Instant Pot books, but what's funny is actually the Instant Pot books have not been as popular this year because nobody needs food in an instant. We actually need food to take a long time because we've got nothing else to do. So the people who are interested in learning how to cook and getting into it, I'm really excited to turn them on to books that are going to be simple but not dumbed down. I have to say one of my favorites is not a new one. It's Julia Tertian's Small Victories, which is such a fantastic opener book because whatever page you open to, it actually looks like something you can make. And the food is easy and delicious, but also they're always, she's got variations on things so you can up your game a bit. And also she's got small victories, like when you take the corn off the cob, break it in half first, and then hold the cob down on, you know, on a flat surface, and it's much easier to get the corn off. Something I hadn't even thought of before I read that, which is amazing. And then Jamie Oliver has a new book called Seven Ways, and that's a really nice, simple break into it book to start with.
Well, thank you so much, Celia. It's always a treat to have you this time of year.
Well, same. I always look forward to it.
That's Celia Sack, owner of Omnivore Books in San Francisco. Visit the Good Food website for her top picks of 2020. And please remember to support your local independent bookstores this time of year, whether it's Omnivore Books in San Francisco, now serving here in Los Angeles, or Kitchen Arts and Letters in New York. I wasn't exaggerating when I told Celia that my favorite book of the year is Red Sands by Caroline Eden. It's the third in her series on Central Asia, and while we may be locked in physically this year, we can travel through her to Kazakhstan's Kyzylkum Desert or to the city of Red Tashkent in Uzbekistan. I'm at a place in my life where I'm a realist. I will never attempt this journey in anything but my imagination. So Red Sands, like Black Sea and Samarkand before, uses food as a passport and anchor to places of historic change and modern loneliness and comfort. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Evan.
Oh, it's so wonderful to have you. What a marvelous book this is.
I'm thrilled to be on. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There's so much in the way you write that harkens back to travel writers of the late 19th and early 20th century. You refer to two authors whose books you carried on these journeys, how they wrote about the value of the everyday and the ordinary. And I feel like this is something many of us are keying into these days. Could you speak a bit about who Ella Christie was and what some of her travel exhortations were?
Yeah, Ella Christie was a formidable traveler. I became interested in her because she was born close to my adopted city of Edinburgh in 1861. And she traveled not once, but twice to Central Asia in 1910 and 1912. And she published her adventures in this book called Through Khiva to Golden Samarkand in 1925. And I loved Ella because she's not a well-known writer. People think of Central Asian writers and they think of Peter Hopkirk and they think of many male writers. Women were traveling to these regions a little bit, but they didn't publish many books. And so I was interested in her from a local perspective, and I've met some of her ancestors here in Scotland. And I was interested in her because She takes pleasure in observing and noticing the domestic and the commonplace, the clothes, the cooking, the workshops in great detail, which is what I like to do. I like to travel slowly and just watch and listen. And she was particularly good at this. She describes things beautifully. So I carried her book literally with me on these journeys, with lots of marks and underlinings. And it was kind of interesting because when she went, she also had government advice about it being unsafe. She was very tenacious. They said, you know, there's plague in some of these regions, the Foreign Office, this was advised her. And they said, you know, if you come across plague, you need to hang a red piece of cloth outside the window so no one comes near you. It's very fitting for today. And she made a note of this guidance and then just went anyway.
Can you give us a sense of how big Kazakhstan is?
Kazakhstan, well, for me as a British person, it's ginormous. It's the ninth largest country in the world. And it's wildly different, the different northeast, southwest.
Can you give us... in terms of that, just to sort of explore that contrast overall of all yeah. the different countries you visit in this book, could you give us two dishes that are an example of the contrasting cultures of this area that you explore?
Yeah, sure. So I think the main thing to understand with Central Asian food is you have traditionally you have the food of the nomads. That's the Kazakhs and the Kyrgyz. So it's mainly meat and milk. And we talk about this in my first book, Samarkand. And then you have the food of the settled people, which are mainly the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, and some of the Turkmens. And when they were settled, they had great bazaars, and the food is slightly more, I don't want to use the word complex, but more layers, more flavors, more cooking, you know, because you're settled, you can do more. So again, shashlik can be made pretty much anywhere. But in Kazakhstan, it's still horse meat, actually. People still crave, enjoy, and ensure their families sometimes have access to horse meat. This is what the nomads ate. It's that and milk and kurut, which is the dried milk curds, which kept the Kazakhs alive during great times of famine. Quite basic, very, very interesting. And Uzbekistan, obviously, it's plov. And plov, you find plov all over the former Soviet Union. But the Uzbeks, I've said this many times, it's true, the Uzbeks and the Tajiks, they're the masters of plov. It's delicious. It's quite complicated to make, although it's quite simple, really. It's a layered rice dish with different toppings, quite seasonal. Quince, when that's in season, often goes on top. So I'd say those are probably the defining different dishes of Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan versus Turkmenistan, which I don't feature in the book, but Tajikistan and Uzbekistan.
One of the things you explore in the book in various essays is nature, both the glorious side of it, the food-giving side of it, and the erosion of, you know, what we've done. And in fact, you have this great sentence that pertains to the Walnut Forest essay. Mm-hmm. Where you say where there are nuts, there are people, and where there are people, there are problems.
Mm. So this was one of the stories I knew I was going to follow up on. Some of the stories I stumbled upon and some I went looking for. And I have been to these forests before, but I hadn't been to these walnut forests in Kyrgyzstan during the harvest time. And I'd heard mixed reports. I'd read travel articles, which were quite kind of like jolly with cheerful families having sort of, you know, jamborees in the forest and big fires and, you know. And then I'd also heard from slightly more cynical journalists that, no, this is not the case and the harvests haven't been good for years. So I wanted to go and find out what the truth was. And unfortunately, it was more the latter. So it's October the 1st when the harvest starts. And quite a lot of heavy mist, huge walnut forests. Some say the largest in the world. I think that probably is correct. I can't find too much that argues with that case. They are huge. No one knows quite how big they are. You can walk all day and not cross them, that's for sure. And they've had a lot of changes over the years. So the Soviets tried to collectivize them, tried to tame what they saw as wild. And then there was a lot of timber extraction. And it's been quite messy. And the case now is that really there hasn't been a really good harvest for 20 years. It's interesting because people still go to the forest. So when I was there, there were families in the forest who would be there for weeks protecting their trees, getting the nuts, selling them at the bazaar down the road. But yeah, it's kind of depressing, to be honest. It certainly wasn't jolly, and it was a bit sad to see these people working really hard for not very much return, and have problems with illegal logging, for example, as well. One man I talked to, Turgenby, in the book, and he basically said they will stay there until the snow comes because they're terrified of illegal loggers coming and taking their trees. So, yeah, it was an interesting story. These enormous walnut forests who've been with us for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they're under great threat. And it's not the only story in the book that talks about our climate emergency. These people are on the front line. They've been there every season for their whole lives, and they, you know, they speak the truth.
One of the most fascinating stories and sort of scenes that you paint in the whole book for me was Karaganda.
Uh-huh.
This city of the cosmos.
Yeah.
Could you just speak a bit about the place and milk, this milk tradition, and in particular, the story of Gertrude Plattis? What a fascinating story.
Thank you for bringing that up, because I feel that that's probably the most interesting story in the book. If I had to pick one, this was the story that really blew my mind, because I didn't know about Karaganda. You know, the Soviet joke is like, where Karaganda? Because it's literally in the middle of nowhere. It's in the giant steppe in the middle of Kazakhstan. So I went there and I was interested in finding out about the Soviets who had hotels built there for them to recuperate. So the rockets would go up from what is now southern Kazakhstan, and they would come down in the steppe surrounding Karaganda because there's so much space and it's very flat. But the dairy lands were especially interesting. I was very lucky to meet a man who runs a dairy business. But he said very early on, and I knew I was going to get a good story, he said, if you want to learn the history, learn the food. So I knew we were on the same page from the beginning. And he talked about how milk is sacred in Kazakhstan, and how it's all they've ever had and it's all they ever needed, and how nomads could take something like a sheep bladder, boil the horse milk inside it, they thicken it, they dry it, and that'd be their food. And then the kumis and the fermented mare's milk, that would be their drink. And that was how they've managed to keep going during very difficult times. I met him at his sort of processing plant, and he talked about how he'd set up. But then when we sort of sat down at the end and he brought some of the products out for me to try, there was a photograph on the back of this woman's face, of Gertrude Plattis. And she was a former prisoner of a women's camp that was up by the new capital, Nur Sultan, in the far north. And she was in this camp, and it was a camp for women and children that had been built by Stalin, and she'd been sent there. And she was having a terrible time and working sort of 15-hour days in the snow in the Karlags, which are the sort of Kazakh gulags. And one day, completely heartbroken, she noticed local villagers, Kazakhs, throwing what she thought were rocks at her. And she collapses down on the ground and she can't take it anymore. And she says, you know, even the locals hate us. You know, I can't carry on like this. And when she goes back to her barracks in the evening, the Kazakh women prisoners knew immediately. And they said to her, these are not stones. They're kurut. They're dried milk curds. People are trying to save you. They're trying to help you. The local villagers, they've been watching these poor women toil in these unbearable circumstances, and they hadn't thrown the rocks to taunt them. They'd thrown them vital sustenance to try and help them, the food that for centuries the Kazakhs themselves had depended on. So he, this wonderful dairy magnate, had put her face on the back of the milk carton to tell this story. And I just thought, wow, talk about joining the dots, because I'd been to the camp, which is now a museum, up outside this, outside the new capital, Nur Sultan, Alzir, and I'd seen these stories, and I'd taken her picture, the photograph of her, which is how I recognised her immediately on the back of the milk carton. So, yeah, it's very, very interesting, the history of milk in Kazakhstan. Much more to learn as well. That's just a very quick introduction.
Well, as always, it's just such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for giving us this marvelous read.
Likewise. Very lovely to talk to you, Evan. Thank you very much.
That is travel writer and journalist Caroline Eden. Her latest book is Red Sands, Reportage and Recipes Through Central Asia from Hinterland to Heartland. In a minute, is it even a holiday if there isn't a new Yotam Ottolenghi cookbook to give to your food-obsessed friends? The King of Cookbooks has a new book out, and it's a stunner. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Any new Ottolenghi book is cause for excitement, especially now when we're getting tired of our own cooking. But flavor brings something different to the conversation and someone new. Issa Belfrage comes from the famously productive Ottolenghi Test Kitchen and is Yotam's primary collaborator on flavor. Expect some particularly welcome additions to our pandemic cooking routines. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. It's good to be there.
Hello.
Yotam, you say that Flavor, your most recent book, is effectively the third in a trilogy, starting with Plenty and Plenty More. Can you describe how that's so?
Plenty and Plenty More were the two first book, and then came Flavor. And Flavor is, in a way, everything that I have learned about vegetables in the last 4 or 5 years since the publication of Plenty More and through the work with Issa. So what we've done in this book is try to collect all our vegetable-focused recipes and give them the Ottolenghi treatment, which is, you know, strong flavors, a lot of wonderful intensity, and really kind of elevating the vegetables. And the way that we've done it is through slightly different ingredients that we do normally. So, you know, the tahini is still there, the za'atar is still there, but Issa has a wonderful background. She spent time in her childhood in Mexico, where she has family, in Brazil, where her mother comes from, and in Italy. And all those influences are coming into effect in the book. So we've got limes, and there's lots of chilies, dried and fresh, and there's all sorts of interesting marinade and combinations that we haven't done before. And Flavor is about all these exciting new combinations.
It's so funny because when I was, you know, flipping through the pages and I came upon chamoy, I said to myself, oh, okay. So Issa, maybe just as a way of introducing you and your flavor palette, you could talk a bit about that recipe and the chamoy.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's a really wonderful recipe to sort of showcase the collaboration between myself and Yotam, because we take inspiration from chamoy, which is obviously a classic Mexican sauce, which comes in different sort of consistencies that can be very runny or slightly thicker. And it's usually made with pickled fruit, often apricots, and with lots of dried chilies and lime. And we've taken sort of that concept and then sort of tried to marry it with a few Middle Eastern flavors as well. So we use sumac and Aleppo pepper there, which is obviously not traditional, but the reason that we called it chamoy is because that is where the inspiration came from, and it would be sort of remiss of us not to mention that. But it's a really nice example of our two sort of backgrounds coming together, and it's quite similar to a Moroccan style carrot salad in the flavors. But yeah, like I said, the inspiration comes from that wonderful acidic, punchy Mexican condiment.
So there are a couple dishes that I want to highlight. The sweet and sour onion petals is so simple and absolutely stunning.
I know. I mean, one of the things that I think we've tried to highlight quite often in the book is how incredible onions are in the not so predictable way, which is as a vehicle for creating flavor or starting dishes. Because we all have we think we know onions quite well and what we do. And, you know, we chop them and we start so many sauces and so many dishes by sauteing onions, maybe with a few other ingredients to create a fundamental for a sauce. But one of the things that we love about the chapter that focuses on onion and garlic is how much, or the allium family, leeks as well, is how much you can achieve by just focusing on the onioniness of the onion, on this incredible quality that onions have. And I've done the previous books, but in this book in particular, we really, really focused on that family. And this particular dish is inspired by what we have often in Turkish restaurants with kebabs, which is charred onion that is then served with pomegranate juice that's reduced into a syrup. And there's really very little going on in this recipe apart from small onions that are charred and cooked and then served with and then broken into the individual petals and served with that pomegranate reduction. And there's very little less going on there. So chili flakes and chives chopped up. And it's just such a colorful thing and such a vibrant, both in terms of flavor and in terms of color, that it's just a really, really happy dish. And I think it just shows you how versatile vegetables are if you can take an onion, which always seems like an auxiliary, and turn it into the very center of a dish, and such a marvelous thing as well.
Okay, so also I would like you to speak to what I would say is the ugliest dish in the book, which is so ugly that you must have it in there for a big flavor reason, and that is bekela.
That's a funny one, actually. Back when I was reading reviews, I don't do that anymore. I mean, a lot of them are great, but some of them are just, you know, not very nice and quite funny. But someone on Amazon described that dish as looking like a bowl full of mud. So it's funny that you bring that up. But and it is true. It does look a bit dark, but it's so full of flavor. And Yotam, do you want to talk about bekela, the Tunisian condiment?
Yeah, so I have to say something that, you know how, Evan, you know how sometimes when you eat something, it tastes so good that you forget what it looks like. And for you, it looks beautiful. So I've had bekela for, you know, in different incarnations over the years. And for me, I think I was kind of blinded by the knowledge of how delicious this thing is, that I just couldn't see how, you know, khaki and brown it is. But in a sense, it is a wonderful thing. And I recommend people that try it only for getting, you know, flipping that reaction of looking at it and thinking, oh. Because what it is an incredible Jewish-Tunisian way of working with spinach and parsley often as well, and cooking them down for a very long time with lots of olive oil. It's something that traditionally was kept in a jar on the kitchen counter, and it's like a base for many, many dishes. It's like you take a lot of spinach and you really cook it for a very long time with olive oil until it becomes almost black. Really almost black, like oil. And that's like, for me, that's like the crystallizing of spinach. It's like the reduction of spinach to its very essence. So it's slightly metallic. But when you mix it up with oil, like olive oil and as we do here, there is obviously chopped up onion, etc. So it turns it this incredible soup. And it's something that we serve with the butter beans and potato, like as a stew here in this recipe. In the restaurant Rovi, it's a base for, is a condiment for a celeriac shawarma, a celery root shawarma, which is our favorite dish. And I think what makes it is that reduced bekela sauce, which is as spinachy as anything you'll ever taste.
Okay, so now my question is this. Every cookbook that you produce seems to have a couple of like it girl recipes, things that rise to the top that you end up seeing over and over on Instagram, people falling in love with them and making it. What are those one or two from this book?
I think for me, I'd say one of the it girls is the miso butter onions, just because they are the most perfect personification of brown and beige, but in the most beautiful way. So it's actually also the shortest ottolenghi recipe ever. It's just got three ingredients, so miso butter and onions and water as well. And it cooks down and the onions become incredibly golden and soft. And I hate to use the phrase melt in the mouth, but there's no other way to describe it. And you get this incredible rich gravy. It's very little ingredients and very little effort. And people seem to be loving that and cooking that a lot.
If I may add, there's also the mushroom lasagna, which is, again, talking about layers and reduction and really kind of focusing the flavors, that is the most mushroomy lasagna you'll ever have. It's got a lot of fresh mushrooms, but also dried porcini mushrooms and parmesan and pecorino. And it is totally and utterly delicious. More better than any meaty lasagna I've ever had.
Thank you so much, you two. This has been so much fun.
Wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you. Really good to talk.
That was Yotam Ottolenghi and Ista Belfrage, co-owners in the new book, Flavor. In the publishing world, Ottolenghi is at one end of the spectrum, and Some Kind Press is at the other. Some Kind is what you call a crowdfunded micropublisher out of Australia, and co-founder Simon Davis has joined with our good friend Ken Concepcion of the cookbook shop Now Serving to publish an exciting slate of cookbooks from our favorite LA restaurants. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi, Evan.
Hello, Evan. It's lovely to talk to you.
It's great to have both of you here. Simon, Some Kind is a crowdfunded and community-focused independent publishing company. Tell us about your titles and how the Takeaway series in particular started.
Of course. Predominantly, we are a food publisher, and Takeaway is our flagship series and is the reason we exist as a publisher. I work on cookery books. I've worked on them my entire career as an editor. And I was working very closely on a very large book by an Australian chef called Aaron Turner down here, a book on hot chicken in Nashville that had taken us 2 years to make and required several trips to the States. This book was released into the world in the first week of the pandemic and lockdown here in Australia. And I was bemoaning the fact that it was going to disappear into the ether with the designer on the book, Vaughan Mossop. And between us and also the author, we talked about whether there was anything that we could do with our experience, whether there was any way that we could help support an industry that we loved. And from that, Takeaway was born.
So Ken, why don't you talk about your involvement? Tell me what you thought when Simon told you about Some Kind and gave you this opportunity.
You know, when we first heard of Some Kind and the ability to make books and make a list of venues and restaurants and bakeries and cafes here in LA that maybe need to be represented a little bit more or wouldn't necessarily have the time or resources to pursue what we think of as a big book or something super glossy and shiny like that. Michelle and I, we were really, really excited. And, you know, we looked to our friends in the restaurant community and the food scene in here in LA. And we see how, along with everyone else, is struggling with what's happened this year. And this felt like a no-brainer to be a part of.
So, Simon, perhaps you could explain to us how the model works.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a crowdfunded publisher. So each of the books that we intend to publish, we release it for pre-sale 2 weeks, a period of 2 weeks. And during that time, we need to get 100 orders for the book to go into production. So if the book doesn't reach 100 copies, all the money that is generated is passed to the venue, and we don't begin work on a book because for financial reasons, it simply wouldn't make us any sense for us or for them. Thankfully, we've actually never had that problem. Every book that we've released for pre-sale has gone on and raised, has sold the 100 copies within that 2 week period. And then once that 2 week period is over, we continue to sell the book. The book continues to be for sale all the way up until the point of print, which is a rather scary 8 to 10 weeks after that end of that period. So these are small books we're talking about. These are not the big magnum opuses, those heavy doorstoppers that if you were to drop them on a child's head might kill them. They are 96-page books, 80 pages of usable content, and really can tell very sort of small and focused stories.
So Ken, the first two choices from your list for Some Kind are Cato and Sonora Town. Why was it so important for you that you feature those two in particular?
Well, you know, making this list was, you know, I joked with the Some Kind team that it was as hard as, you know, the seating arrangements at Michelle and I's wedding. You know, it was really tough to break it down to, you know, 10 or 12 venues here in LA. But, you know, with Cato and with Sonora Town, we really wanted to focus on the diversity of the food and diversity of the people. I don't think you can't love the food in LA if you don't love the people here. Both Cato and Sonora Town, it's immigrant-driven cuisine. You know, it's a pretty modest setup as far as a strip mall or a storefront in the fashion district downtown. And, you know, obviously, in our minds, the food is world-class.
One of the things that's so interesting to me about this this whole idea of Some Kind is the ability for the chefs, restaurateurs, or bakers, whoever's involved in the projects, to tell different kind of stories than they might if it were a bigger book in a more, you know, sort of traditional package. Are you finding that that's true?
Yes, very much. I think right at the beginning, we were surprised and delighted by that. I think originally we thought these books might have to be quite tightly structured and formatted books, possibly 20 to 30 recipes, that kind of traditional recipe in picture. I think very early on, when we were confronted with our authors wanting to tell us, they wanted to tell us their own stories, and their own stories very much diverged from that strict structure. We have a Sri Lankan restaurant here in Sydney called Lankan Filling Station. The chef, Otama Kerry, wanted to tell the story of the curry powder that forms the backbone of her cooking. So each chapter is a narrative on the different spices. And then at the end of the book, we just have the one recipe for the curry powder.
Could you maybe tease us a little bit with something that perhaps Chef John Yao addressed while he was putting together the Cato book?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we first spoke to John Yao about the book and the concept of the book, I think he really got the idea that we weren't just after recipes, you know, that it wasn't just a recipe book that he was putting together, that he could go in whatever direction he wanted. And he really wanted to tell the story of Cato, but to tell the story of the mistakes they'd made. And I think that's fantastic. I think far too few people want to admit to failures or mistakes, but that's where we learn the most. And he thought that this would be the most useful to an audience of his that would seize him achieving so much in the world of hospitality, in his world, to be able to talk about those mistakes is incredible.
So Ken, you and Michelle own a bookstore, a cookbook store, now serving. And the role of a bookstore traditionally has been to buy books at a wholesale price and then sell them at a retail price, thus surviving and hopefully making some money along the way. And of course, with the pandemic, your small business has been affected like all small businesses have. What was it about Some Kind that made you want to do it despite its unusual model?
That's a great question. I think it was about giving opportunity to those who wouldn't necessarily have that opportunity given to them. You know, whether it's a Taiwanese restaurant in a strip mall or a food truck or, you know, a bakery that's been around for, you know, a couple of decades. I think in the modern food scene here in America and in LA especially, you know, there is so much, you know, obviously pre-COVID, there's so much new going on. And with this list, Michelle and I, we wanted to focus on the places that were tied to communities, and whether that be immigrant-driven or geographic communities here in LA. I mean, we did have a condition that we kind of set up for ourselves where The places that we picked, we wanted them to be around for at least 3 years. So that could kind of clear the headspace in order to make a decision not based on recency bias. And we wanted it to be, these places on in the series to be accessible. And I think just to be able to create a list like this, create a books that give the chefs and the bakers and the restaurant owners a voice, you know, that's all we want to do with the bookstore as well.
Will the books be available in the bookstore as well as through some kind?
Absolutely.
Well, Simon and Ken, thank you both so much for joining us. What a really fascinating project on so many levels.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Ken Concepcion of Now Serving and Simon Davis of Some Kind Press. We've been discussing their Takeaway LA series of books. The Market Report is next when Good Food continues. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Finally, we finish off the show with the Market Report. Our correspondent, Jillian Ferguson, has this report from Torrance.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We are in the South Bay this week at the Torrance Farmers Market, and I'm talking with Johnny Lee, who is the chef owner behind the Cantonese-inspired restaurant Pearl River Deli in Chinatown. Johnny, I know you come to this market a lot. What are you shopping for this week?
So this week I'm looking at different fruits that we can use in our upcoming kakigori program. We're going to start doing Japanese-inspired shaved ice that is usually very fruit-based.
So describe what kakigori is for someone who's never had it before.
So the style of kakigori usually involves shaving ice into like thin shavings rather than like little small crushed ice or what some people might call like snow. So it is literally shaved ice. We freeze a large cylindrical tube of ice, and then we use our hand crank machine to try to get like as thin as possible shaving so that the ice is actually like as soft as possible.
And so we're here at the market. There's a ton of fall fruit that's still here, as well as the citrus that's coming in. How do you decide what toppings you're going to put on the kakigori?
So the way I would approach the toppings is I try to balance the flavors of citrus in terms of bitter, sweet, and sour. And I try to imagine fresh fruit topping. They had these little nice Kishu mandarin oranges that I'm definitely going to use to make a syrup out of. And I see some Mara lemons coming in, so I think we might use either a zest to either as just like a topping, like to grate the zest on top, or we might infuse the zest and some of the juice into a cream as a whipped cream topping.
Oh, that sounds so good. You mentioned the Kishu, which is one of my favorite winter citrus. It's a small seedless mandarin. Describe the flavor of it.
Yeah, so imagine like your regular Satsuma tangerine mandarin oranges, but they don't have any of that astringency or sourness. Especially, I've noticed after they sit for like a few days to a week, like the flavor mellows out a lot, and they don't actually get sweeter, but they get more, it becomes more mellow.
Well, Johnny, thank you so much. I can't wait to try it.
All right, thank you.
That was Johnny Lee, chef and owner of Pearl River Deli in Chinatown. You can place takeout orders by calling the restaurant. Check out his Instagram page, PRD_LA, for all the details. One of the farmers who brings citrus to the Torrance Farmers Market is Renata Baum of Arby's Ranch. Renata is a certified organic grower down in Fallbrook. And Renata, you have some citrus here. You've got grapefruit, limes. You also have something else which I would love to ask you about, which is fresh macadamia nuts. Tell us a little bit about your farm and how you got into growing down in Fallbrook.
I will tell you about the fact that I am foreign. I'm not Italian. I am Italian. I'm not from California. The ranch came to me because I'm married to the Californian guy. He bought the ranch 25 years ago, and the macadamias were already 20 years old. Now we have like almost 300 trees. They are really old, 4 years old now. And we are maybe four or five growers of macadamias in towards San Diego. My husband, he never sold the macadamias directly, like I'm selling right now. He used to sell to another grower, which he did for years at Santa Monica's Farmers Market. But this guy passed away. I feel sorry about him. Oh. This was Jim Russell. We used to sell it to him, all our crop, but because he passed away, then the family is not going to follow to do the farming. We got like stuck, and I told my husband at this point why I cannot go and do what he was doing. It was a little bit like a joke in the beginning, but now it's becoming a real business. We do three markets in Saturday, three markets in Sunday, and one Tuesday in Torrance, where we are now.
So the macadamias that you have here at the market today are a fresh crop that were harvested just a month ago in October. Describe for us the difference between the flavor and texture of a fresh macadamia and then the nuts that we can find on grocery store shelves.
The first difference is the bleaching process. The bleaching process is the way to maintain the macadamias still white. Our macadamias are not processed with anything at all, no preservatives, nothing. The one that stay longer, of course, in the stores, they are all bleached because they come from different other states, from Europe like Turkish or from Hawaii. The closer they come, the less preservatives they have, but still, even coming from outside, they have to have the bleaching process, which is a leather of fat. It's not bleach on it, it's only the leather of fat that preserve the whiteness of the macadamias. But that changed the flavor a lot.
Well, I'm so happy to meet you. I'm really sorry to hear about Jim Russell, but it's great that people can find your macadamia nuts at the farmer's market these days. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Renata Baum of Arby's Ranch, a certified organic farm down in Fallbrook. You can find her at the Tuesday and Saturday Torrance markets, the Saturday, Sunday Santa Monica markets, Sunday Mar Vista, and Saturday in Irvine. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. Please order takeout, buy merch, get gift cards, support independent restaurants like their life depends on it, because it does. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.